Experience glowing wild and illuminated Wildlife Lantern Festival at the Sundial Bridge and Turtle Bay Exploration Park in Redding, California. Open select nights April 4th through June 8th, 7 to 10 p.m. Featuring 10 acres of illuminated gardens filled with Asian lanterns inspired by plants and animals from around the world. Plus food, drinks, live performances on select nights, and much more. Don't miss Turtle Bay's Glowing Wild Lantern Festival at the Sundial Bridge. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Hi friends, RC here with Tobacco and Brew, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor. Henry Clay, Warhawk, Rebellious. Backed by popular demand, this limited edition Toro is sure to please. Another fine example of Nicaraguan tobacco blended by AJ Fernandez. Complex, smooth, chocolatey Habano wrapper, a satisfying smoke with a clean finish. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Do you have a crazy schedule and can't seem to get to a class to qualify for your CCW, CCW renewal, or maybe learn to use that new firearm you just purchased? Consider a private class with NFI. Learn to shoot a handgun, rifle, shotgun, or even a BB gun. Classes are taught by an instructor that you choose on your dates and location. Give NFI a call at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and I'll see you at the range.
Invest in your future today with a degree or certificate from Shasta College. Get job ready fast with one of our high demand career technical programs like nursing, heavy equipment, and welding. Or work on transferring to a CSU or UC with guaranteed placement. Full-time students get 2 years tuition free. Summer session begins June 9th. Click or call 242-7650. Your success starts at Shasta College.
Do you have something you'd like to get painted? Then bring it to Victory Powder Coating. Powder coating is a durable, colorful, environmentally friendly alternative to paint. It's useful in automotive, agricultural, decorative, and high-temperature applications. Victory Powder Coating has become the North State leader in powder coating applications and metal finishing. They specialize in large industrial items like truck beds, agricultural equipment, and trailers. They're dedicated to providing superior work and outstanding customer care. Consider Victory Powder Coating for your next project. Victory Powder Coating.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
Hey, it's Cindy at Laux Landscape Supply, and it's time for our spring sale, April 12th through the 19th. That's right, it's your chance to save on all your spring projects, like the estate retaining wall block as low as $5.99 a block, or 2.5 gallon jugs of Ranger Pro for only $59. Our popular garden power soil will be on sale for $49.99 a yard. The rain's about over. Do you need to fill the potholes? Road base starts as low as $34 a yard. Or maybe you're building a patio. The Artisan Slate Premier three-piece combo in a choice of three colors is marked down to $499.99. For 122 square foot pallet, 50 pound bags of triple 15 fertilizer for only $29.99. Save big on all the many options of landscape fabric, garden tools, pond products, and so much more at Laux Landscape Supply, April 12th through the 19th. So plan your project now. Give us a call at 378-2220. Check us out on the web at LauxLandscape.com or just come see us at the intersection of Dersh, Stern Creek, and Airport Road. Laux Landscape Supply, where we take pride in your project.
Came from this idea that government is sort of special. Government's made of experts, and therefore, even though they kind of believe in a free press, they kind of believe that expert opinion matters more than the free press. And this is really downstream from the progressive era in the United States. And so a free press isn't actually sort of the highest sort of political value for them. reforming whatever needs to be reformed or changing whatever needs to be changed is. It means that government's really the highest value and what the government sort of sees as necessary rather than the freedom of the press or the freedom of speech broadly.
You also say that a free press makes occasional messes. Why is that okay? What's the ultimate benefit we receive as citizens, even if there are a few messes along the way?
So the ultimate point of a free press is not to get the right information to the people. It's not to sort of litigate even truth. The point of a free press is a free press. And that means that that free press can be messy at times. It can get a lot of stuff wrong. But that's actually the point of the free press. I think a lot of people, when they think, okay, well, isn't the point of the press, isn't the point of the press to sort of find truth? Well, no, actually, that's the point of something like church or universities. That's not the point of the press. The point of the press is to have active dialogue, active speech, all sorts of voices, good, bad, and ugly, that sort of allow the people to discern truth. The point of a free press is for the people to have those voices.
You write in this piece at Law and Liberty that the American press's very multiplicity of opinion, in fact, strengthened the liberties of the United States and guarded them from tyranny. So how so?
Well, because the number of voices was important, besides because if you only have one voice, you probably don't have a lot of freedom. If you only have one sort of voice saying this is officially what we have to believe, then you probably don't have a free press. It's that multiplicity of opinions and voices that lets people know, hey, we're litigating this with complete freedom, or as close as complete freedom as we can get in the United States of Republican order. When you just have one voice, anytime you just have one opinion in the United States, historically people get suspicious, and rightfully so.
Mm-hmm.
And so Americans are actually pretty good at freedom, or have been for a long time, and so they figure out, hey, if there's only one opinion, that means that somebody's being told not to say something. Somebody's sort of not as free as they might ought to be.
Dr. Miles Smith with us. Find this piece at lawliberty.org, America's free press tradition. This idea of the multiplicity of opinions. I was at an event recently for journalists, and the speaker, the panel, was extolling the virtues of the free press, and it's the most important thing, and autocracies don't have a free press. but it's so important that we have to be careful not to get things wrong. And that's why we need to license journalists. So the only people who have been trained to give Americans facts and opinions are the ones who can be journalists. Now, I could not follow that in my head. What would the founders have thought about this idea that journalists need to be licensed to practice the craft?
Oh, they would have thought it's ridiculous, because it would be the government licensing people. It's not the government's job to govern journalism. Journalism is supposed to be free. Free press is supposed to be free. So the idea that the government would be some sort of referee over saying who could be a journalist would strike them as crazy. And it's funny, because they might have actually sort of appreciated the outcome of those of a licensing journalist. John Adams makes the mistake of at least sort of leaning on journalists with the government, and he pays the electoral price for it. He's thrown out of office after one term. And so I think that the idea that journalism is something you can even be a sort of licensed expert in is sort of ridiculous. The listeners can't see us, but we're smiling at each other, sort of almost laughing about the idea that what does a licensed journalist look like? Is it like dentistry? Is it like ophthalmology?
That's the comparison that was made. It's like, we license doctors and we license this, and that's why, but it's a completely different idea.
Yeah. And the reason it's different is, of course, is because journalism is literature.
Mm-hmm.
You don't license people to be authors. Right? We don't go around saying, well, this person can be a children's author and this person can't. And the reason is because ideas aren't meant to be governed like, say, the military is meant to be governed. So anytime you license something, you're basically applying almost a sort of military, or at least a state apparatus to it. And so how many people want to have a state governed media apparatus? That's essentially what you're asking for. When you're asking for licensing, you're asking for state media.
Down a similar road with, there are individual states now, I know Illinois is doing this, but California is doing this, we're providing tax credits or to journalistic organizations to hire more employees, to do more reporting. When you have the state funding, even in a tax credit way, journalism itself, conflicts naturally are going to arise.
Yeah, I mean, the journalism is governed, if you will, by the people. And so if the people don't want to read something, why should the government sort of decide that the people get to read it? If we are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, people get to decide what they're going to read without the intervening hand of the state. And so, yeah, the very notion of even state-subsidized media is being questioned. I guess you saw there was the woman who runs NPR now. And so their funding is probably going to be, if not yanked, then at least threatened significantly. Why? Because she stopped believing in her own press. And I mean that sort of tongue-in-cheek. She stopped believing in the press that was sort of downstream from all the free speech commitments of the First Amendment. And the people don't like that. Americans don't like their media governed very much.
We'll pause there and return with Dr. Miles Smith. We'll talk more about America's free press tradition in a moment. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Welcome to the Grammar Minute, where we're saving the English language 60 seconds at a time. I'm Lauren Smith, and I wasn't born in the 80s, but I'm going to use it to make a point. You might already know there's an apostrophe in front of 80 to denote that you've dropped the 19. But oddly, the direction of the apostrophe actually matters. Notice how when you type an apostrophe in the computer, it's slightly curved in one direction. That curve should be concave to whatever is omitted. So in the 80s example, the apostrophe should look sort of backward. This is surprisingly difficult to type into the computer. You may actually have to type a letter, write the apostrophe, and then delete the letter to get it pointing in the correct direction. Now, you may be asking, is anyone really going to notice that? Yes, I can guarantee that you will the next time you see it printed incorrectly, now that you've listened to this episode. And that's your Grammar Minute. Visit thegrammarminute.com for more tips and tricks.
You're listening to What's in a Name. So this particular Michigan city's name at first look has a fairly simple origin story. It's a bit more complicated than it first seems. The name Detroit comes from a French word that means straight, like a body of water, which in turn comes from the city's positioning around the Detroit River. The river comes from Lake Erie, one of the five Great Lakes. The city still remains as one of the oldest and most important cities in the Midwest. So the name comes from French settlements in the early 18th century, which was roughly 300 years ago. The land itself has been populated for over 11,000 years by many different peoples, including the Iroquois and the Hurons. Rich in resources, it was highly contested, and after many battles, ultimately ended up within the United States, first as a territory and then as part of the state of Michigan. It has since earned the nickname of the Motor City due to its history with Henry Ford. This has been What's in a Name. My name is Megan Pidcock, and you're listening to Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM.
Hi, I'm Joshua Palladino, a PhD candidate at Hillsdale College. Here's master's student Theodore Madrid with a message from Thomas Jefferson on the role of the federal and state governments under the Constitution.
In a letter to Judge William Johnson, Thomas Jefferson said, "I believe the states can best govern our home concerns, the general government our foreign ones. I wish, therefore, to see maintained that wholesome distribution of powers established by the Constitution for the limitation of both, and never to see all offices transferred to Washington, where, further withdrawn from the eyes of the people, they may more secretly be bought and sold as at market."
Hillsdale College, pursuing truth, defending liberty since 1844.
I'm Corinne, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is president of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arndt, on the threat of bureaucratic despotism.
One of the chief sponsors of the Dodd-Frank finance reform bill called that legislation, quote, "about as important as it gets, because it deals with every single aspect of our lives," end quote. And how does this legislation deal with every aspect of our lives? In the most unconstitutional way. It sets up a board called the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which has the power to regulate our economic transactions independently of both the President and Congress. In other words, permanent government employees are placed in charge of us beyond the control of those we elect, the control of we the people. This is a violation of the representative form of government without which there can be no constitutional government.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket constitution and declaration, go to constitutionminute.com.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertrand. We've been talking with Dr. Miles Smith from Hillsdale's History Department about a piece he wrote for Law and Liberty at lawliberty.org. It's America's Free Press Tradition. Dr. Smith, in the previous segment, I was talking to you about this gathering of journalists in which one of the journalists suggested licensing journalists. You had to have a license to practice journalism. It was too important to the country not to have people trained and licensed to practice journalism. I mentioned how ridiculous we both found that. My students were also on hand that day. My students who were with me when the idea of licensing journalists came about were not perplexed, but they were confused. They hadn't heard it before, but this is not a new idea. Senator Dick Durbin from Illinois has been a big fan of licensing journalists now for at least a decade, and it bubbles up every now and then. You argue in your piece that American government's commitment to free press has always been most tenuous in wartime. Mm-hmm. Now, we're not in wartime at the moment. How would you judge our current government's commitment to the free press?
Well, I think that since 9/11, there's kind of been almost a perpetual wartime in some ways. And so I don't think the press is necessarily as reflexively free as we'd like to think or as it should be. One of the things I think is interesting is that wartime is where you have an added excuse.
Mm-hmm.
You have this excuse of life and death. Well, if we let anybody print anything, they'll do X. And what's really interesting is historically, the press has almost policed itself during wartime. You would have, in the Civil War, you would have journalists basically sort of say, okay, I'm committed to the free press, but I am also a citizen of the United States, and I want the United States government to have sort of the ability to run the war it needs to run. And so there was sort of a self-policing on that. The idea that a journalist would just go publish, say, the position of a unit that was sensitive or something like that, that's kind of ahistorical. It just never happens. Because journalists are people and they're oftentimes citizens.
Mm-hmm.
So just because I think we have this idea that journalists are some sort of stateless peoples, right? No, I think that actually historically journalists are rather patriotic and, they care about their country. It's only recently sort of the en masse ideology about what journalism is. Has changed it. But I mean, even the generation of even sort of lefty journalists, I think of like a guy like William Safire or someone like that in the era before our own. I can't imagine them just publishing where a group of soldiers might be sort of, you know, threatened or something. I can't imagine them doing that. So I think that what you see is, not just since since 9/11, but government doesn't trust the people, and mm-hmm. they don't trust the government, the journalist anymore. So it's actually the state doesn't trust anybody anymore, rather than sort of journalists just being these kind of walking security threats or something.
Same. There are reasons people don't necessarily trust journalists anymore, and we saw part of this through the COVID era, which in some ways is still ongoing. You read about this in this piece at Law and Liberty. Why is it dangerous for the media to act merely as, I believe the phrase that you use in here, a government information service?
Well, because the government can get things wrong. And so if you preclude all other voices, you basically establish a paradigm in which the government gets to be God, doctor, church, scientist, everything without any pushback. And so the reason it's not good for the press to be a government information service is that the government's voice is supposed to be treated as just one among many. And the good example now is COVID. They got a bunch of stuff wrong. But the telemedia was so deeply wedded to the state during that season. You think about what was all sort of the legacy media people were carrying, that they destroyed any credibility they had with the people precisely because the people, it's not that they were unwilling to listen to arguments made by the government. It was that the government said, we're the only argument that can be right and you can't listen to the other ones. That's what people were really upset about. And so it wasn't that everybody wanted to think that Joe Rogan was correct about, say, ivermectin or something. It's that the government had basically implied that if you listen to Joe Rogan, right, you were sort of not an American or you were sort of un-American. And so the idea is not that anybody is needing a specific voice to be right. It's that they want to let all the voices talk. And if you try to shut down the voices, the American people, I think to their credit, sniff that out and say, I don't think you care about the truth. I think you care about control. And I think there's something rather noble about the American people. We give Americans a hard time a lot of times, but I think that's actually something that's rather noble. Americans probably, broadly, have a better sense of what it is to have a free press tradition than the government does a lot of times.
Why do you think it was so easy for many in the free press, many media members, to so easily slip into that role?
I can't remember any time when the press just was so devoted to a government polemic in my lifetime. I'm guessing my parents' lifetime. I mean, the press was an enemy of the government in Vietnam, right? I mean, the press is trying to actively push Lyndon Johnson. The same thing with Reagan, with Bush. So any important president, I don't know. I'd hate to just to think that the press, the legacy telemedia organizations are just ideological crazies. That seems to be a part of it, though. They all were trained at the same places, right? Their journalistic training was really ideological training. I mean, they're all, they go to what, three schools? Missouri, Northwestern. Mizzou, Northwestern. What's the other schools with the
NYU?
Yeah, NYU. Yeah. They're coming out of these three or four places, and so there's an ideological bent to their training. And so what it is to be a journalist doesn't seem to mean the same thing. I mean, think about a guy like Joe Rogan, who isn't meaningfully a journalist, but he kind of looks like what a journalist historically looks like, just sitting around sort of asking questions. I mean, if I were to present Joe Rogan as an ideal journalist at, say, NYU or Mizzou or Northwestern, I'd probably get shouted down.
Mm-hmm.
It would be a ridiculous proposition. But it seems like he's done a better job getting information, or at least some information, to the people. And so I think almost it's as if journalistic training has become ideological training rather than training to do journalism. And not being a journalist, that's just me kind of like, you know, just throwing stuff into the wind and wondering. But it's a really good question. I can't remember anything like what we saw in COVID.
Dr. Miles Smith, his piece at Law and Liberty, America's Free Press Tradition, lawliberty.org. Dr. Smith, Assistant Professor of History here at Hillsdale College, thanks for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you, Scott.
Up next, Justin Shubo joins us. He's president of the National Civic Art Society. We'll talk about the importance of the classical tradition in public art and architecture and what might happen under the Trump administration. We also want to say hello and thank you for listening to new listeners at our new affiliate, KOMY, AM 1340 in Santa Cruz, California, home of Schoolhouse Radio. Thank you for tuning in to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. For a full list of radio affiliates across the country, head to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and click the Affiliates button. Up next, Justin Shubo. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
You're listening to KCNR 96.5 FM at 1460 AM, your talk radio. Online at kcnr1460.com.
Need help with your health insurance? We've got you covered. At Shasta Community Health Center, we offer this free service to our community. Our enrollment counselors can assist you with new applications, renewals, troubleshooting, and answering your questions about covered California plans or Medi-Cal, also known as Medicaid or Partnership Health Plan. We're here to help you make the best choice for you and your family. Call our outreach and enrollment team at 530-229-5117 to get help today. Shasta Community Health Center, because SCHC cares.
Attention veterans. Did you know that Shasta College and Simpson University have veterans resource centers to assist you in your educational pursuits? These centers offer a wide range of support services, including financial aid, tutoring, IT support, and more. We understand the unique challenges that veterans face and are committed to helping you succeed. Our experienced staff is here to help you navigate the college experience and achieve your academic and career goals. Don't let anything stand in your way. This message is brought to you by Senator Maurice Johannesson, former Secretary of California Veterans Affairs.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. She had minor damage to her rear bumper. I wrote her an estimate. Later, I received a call. The lady responsible for the damage wanted to pay for the repairs out of pocket. Her insurance agent told her a claim would raise her rates for years. With our experience in the claim process, I explained to her most insurance companies would forgive a claim if the cost was below a minimum amount. I suggested she contact her insurance agent and have them review her policy. She called back very excited. It appeared her policy did extend forgiveness. They would pay for the repairs, and she wouldn't be charged with a claim or have to pay a deductible. The accident would not cost her a thing. She was very pleased. Good thing the vehicle owner came to the right place for repairs. We all pay a lot for insurance. Choosing Coachmaster will ensure you get the most for your money. Let this experience work for you. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
It's April, and you know what that means. Hot Cars and Cool April Nights is back. This year is going to be bigger than ever, so mark your calendars for 10 days of classic car fun. This year has more show and shines, a drive-in movie, and don't forget about the cruise on Friday, April 25th, followed by the biggest show and shine of them all on Saturday, April 26th. 2,000 classic cars on display, tons of great food, amazing unique vendors, and tons of chances for you to win with a poker walk and raffle city throughout the day. Get your wristbands at any local Napa Auto Parts store. And remember, Cool April Nights returns April 18th through the 27th. So update those calendars now and also get a full schedule of events at CoolAprilNights.com. Okay, to recap, Cool April Nights starts on Friday, the 18th. Goes for the next 10 days through April 27th, with the big cruise happening on Friday the 25th and the biggest show and shine of them all on April 26th. We'll see you cruising this April.
Owners, landlords, and tenants trust Authority Property Management at 2663 Victor Avenue. They manage a variety of properties, including single-family homes, apartments, condos, townhouses, multifamily properties, and commercial properties. Authority Property Management offers full-time management, including finding and screening tenants, rent collection, financial reporting, and final walkthrough home inspections when they move out. Contact Authority Property Management today at 530-410-6085 and check out their website at authoritypm.com.
Hello there, this is Kevin Cry. Starting March 12th, every other Sunday, I will be on KCNR, Your Talk Radio, 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. I will be discussing the issues that matter to you most. You'll be able to call in directly, ask questions, and have a dialogue open and free every other Sunday right here on KCNR, Your Talk Radio.
The Reading Regional Chapter of Safari Club International 31st Annual Banquet will be Saturday, April 26th at the Wind River Events Center. Doors will open at 5 p.m. There will be games, live and silent auctions, and drawings, which will include over $35,000 in prizes for hunting, camping, and plenty of items for the ladies. We look forward to a fun evening in support of the world's largest wildlife conservation organization. To purchase tickets, go to scireading.org. That's scireading.org.
Looking for work? O2 Employment Services has been working with local job seekers for the past 20 years. If you're tired of uploading your resume and getting no response, it's time to let O2 help you find that perfect position. Oh, and by the way, you pay absolutely nothing for our service. If you'd like our help, head on over to our website at o2es.com, click apply now, and complete our online application. We have connections with over 600 local businesses. Once we have your information and understand what you're looking for, for, we can introduce you to all the positions you may wish to consider. We currently have over 100 available positions, and we would love to match you with the one you're looking for. O2 Employment Services, the North State's leading staffing agency. Give us a call at 530-223-4674. That's 530-223-4674. Or visit us online at o2es.com.
Hey, it's your liberty-loving Latino amigo, Rich Valdez, host of America at Night. Weeknights, we're letting you know what's happening live all across America. We'll have newsmakers and experts coming on, talking about the hot topics of the day. Plus, in our third hour, whatever you want to talk about with open phones across America, our nightly town hall. I look forward to hearing from you on the next America at Night with me, Rich Valdez.
Weeknights from 7 to 10 p.m. on KCNR.
KCNR invites you to join us the second Friday of the month starting at 8 a.m. for the Gorman Law Hour featuring local attorney Patrick Gorman, a legal expert when it comes to injured workers, compensation claims, and employee claims. So, if you have a legal question or just wonder whether or not you have a legal issue or problem, talk to Patrick Gorman, attorney at law, during the Gorman Law Hour starting at 8 a.m. the second Friday of the month on KCNR.
Join Aaron and Bill for We the People Radio, Sundays, noon until 2.
It's conservative talk radio with a liberal dose of humor. Get the whole story from experts around the world delivering facts rather than opinion.
Missed a show? Busy at noon? No problem. Listen to our free archives when you have time. No commercial interruptions or download restrictions. We the People Radio.
.us.
What shall we do about them?
Lincoln Memorial, in their mind. It is a classical building with columns and steps. It is based on the design of an ancient Greek temple. You ascend, it's made of marble and expensive materials. You ascend the steps, go through the colonnade, and then see this unbelievable statue of Lincoln in the middle. And I think, you know, there's a reason why it's one of the great symbols of the United States. It's a classical design fitting in with what the founding fathers sought for Washington, D.C., which is that it ought to be a classical city. Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, both of them talented amateur architects, and in fact, Jefferson was an actual genius, they consciously decided that the core buildings of Washington would be classical in design. They wished to hearken back to democratic precedents in ancient Rome and Greece. And we ended up with buildings like the White House and the Capitol. These are classical buildings, and the founders inaugurated a tradition that lasted for about 150 years. And that tradition continued, as I was, just implying, into the 20th century with buildings like the U.S. Supreme Court, which is built which was completed in the 1930s, the quote-unquote modern era. But after World War II, the federal government went almost completely modernist in design. These buildings completely rejected tradition in the past, discarded with all ornament, no more columns, no more pediments, and in my view, essentially discarded beauty altogether. The emblematic worst of these post-war buildings is the J. Edgar Hoover building, headquarters of the FBI. That is what's called a brutalist style of architecture. It is made up of raw expanses of exposed concrete, deep-set windows with a relentless grid of windows, and there is this looming mass over your head at one part of the building. And to me, the building has a sinister air. I like to say that it's the Ministry of Fear. These brutalist buildings, which were prevalent mid-century, especially in Washington for federal buildings, they embody faceless bureaucracy. This is not the image of America that I think ordinary people wish to see. And you know, it was a wrong turn in federal architecture. And what I would like to see, and we can talk about in a second, what I think President Trump would like to see is a return to the classical tradition.
Justin, I'll ask about the Trump administration here in a minute, but I wanted to know, is there a financial aspect to this? Does it cost more to embrace the classical design in architecture?
In architecture, I did an analysis of federal courthouses authorized in the same year, and I found that the cost per square foot of classical and modernist buildings was almost exactly the same. So it's just not true that classical buildings are necessarily more expensive than modernist ones.
When we get to the Trump administration, and let's talk about the first term and then slide into the second term, the first Trump administration term, what was done on the issues of art and architecture, and what was he able to accomplish during his 4 years in office?
Well, in 2020, at the very end of his term, Trump issued an executive order on federal architecture. It was an incredible revolutionary order that reoriented federal architecture, which had been almost entirely modernist. It reoriented architecture in a classical and traditional direction, stating that there should be special regard for classical and traditional styles when federal buildings were being designed. It stated that federal buildings ought to be beautiful. They should ennoble the United States, inspire the American people. And it also said that there needs to be input from the general public when design decisions are being made. The order was at its strictest regarding Washington, D.C., requiring that all new federal buildings there be classical. Unfortunately, the order was issued at the end of his term. Everything got slowed down due to COVID. And unsurprisingly, almost immediately after taking office, President Biden revoked the order without providing any reason for doing so. But the architectural establishment, which is almost entirely modernist, had been heavily lobbying him. Plus, there was the weight of elite opinion. As a case in point, the New York Times editorial board published an editorial titled, "What's So Great About Fake Roman Columns?" Fake Roman Temples.
Mm-hmm.
It was an attack on contemporary classical architecture. The implication of what the Times wrote, of course, is that the U.S. Capitol, the Supreme Court, the Jefferson Memorial, these are all equally fake Roman temples, right? These are not 2,000-year-old buildings. And so there was all this pressure, and Biden, unfortunately, undid the order.
We'll return in just a moment. More with Justin Shubo, president of the National Civic Art Society. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
You have a choice when it comes to your cancer care, and I want you to know that at Valor Oncology, we are here to provide the best possible care right here in Reading. I'm Dr. Lauren Strickland, Valor's breast oncology surgeon, and I'm proud to serve this community that I call home. When you come to Valor Oncology, you'll see the same dedicated team at every visit, physicians who know your history and are committed to your care. We offer state-of-the-art technology that rivals major cancer centers, combined with the personalized care you deserve. We are not just a team of doctors. We are part of the fabric of this community, and we are here for you today and tomorrow. When it comes to your health, you deserve expert care, compassion, and stability. Ask your doctor to refer you to Valor Oncology because we're committed to you and we're committed to Reading. Call 530-900-4000 or visit valor.org to schedule a consultation. Valor Oncology, rooted in Reading, focused on you.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wynn Carpenter and Terry Raposa and Janet Chandler. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archive link.
Come out and play. Have you seen the bill? We all have to pay. The time has come for 51 in a Jefferson state of mind.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
Join Aaron and Bill for We the People Radio, Sundays, noon until 2.
It's conservative talk radio with a liberal dose of humor. Get the whole story from experts around the world delivering facts rather than opinion.
Missed a show? Busy at noon? No problem. Listen to our free archives when you have time. No commercial interruptions or download restrictions. We the People Radio.
.us.
What shall we do about them?
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Follow us on X at Hillsdale Radio for updated show and guest information. We continue our conversation here with Justin Shubo, president of the National Civic Art Society, about the classical tradition in public art and architecture. Justin,
I wanted to ask about your involvement in the creation of the World War I Memorial, the new memorial in Washington, D.C. Saban Howard, the sculptor, was recently a guest on one of our other podcasts here, the Larry Arnn Show. He had a great conversation with Dr. Arnn, president of Hillsdale College, about the World War I Memorial. Our listeners can check that out. What was your involvement in the creation of that memorial?
Well, I was friends with the man most responsible for designing the memorial and building it, a man named Edwin Fountain. He was vice chairman of the commission behind it. And from the very beginning, you know, I spoke with Edwin about mistakes of recent national memorials like the Eisenhower Memorial, which went very badly, and explained to Edwin what we needed to have was an open design competition, open to not just professional architects, but artists, sculptors, you name it. And importantly, the competition brief needed to say that the design shall evoke heroism and valor. And the reason it was important to put those words in there is because the general trend in our national memorials ever since the Vietnam Veterans Memorial is that we build nothing but victim memorials. It's not possible for an artist to design something that is heroic or shows that heroism actually exists. And I think the ultimate example of this is the United Flight 93 memorial in Pennsylvania, where that airplane went down on September 11. You know, as you surely know, the passengers on that flight stormed the cockpit, you know, and stopped the terrorists from flying the airplane into a core building of government in Washington. What those passengers did, ordinary citizens, is up there with Paul Revere's ride in American history. Yet the memorial in Pennsylvania contains nothing commemorating the heroism of the passengers on that flight. So the World War I, the people behind it, wished to take a different direction. They did hold a blind open design competition, And, I mean, I'll be honest, I encouraged Saban Howard, the winning sculptor, who is a good friend of mine, to enter the competition. And Saban is an incredibly talented classical sculptor, and I think his final work speaks for itself. It's a beautiful, inspiring design, cinematic in its scope and telling, all sorts of tempos, emotional, there's a lot of emotional range. It shows, yes, the suffering and trauma of the war, but it also does show the heroism of the soldiers heading into the crucible of battle. And perhaps most shocking at all for a contemporary national memorial, it's actually patriotic. At the end of the memorial, there is a victory parade with the soldiers marching arm in arm, holding the American flag, with America on the ascendant, on the world stage. And I would like to think that this memorial shows that the classical tradition is alive and well, and opens up a new direction for our commemorative works.
With Donald Trump taking office once again, January 20th, 2025, a new memorandum promoting beautiful federal civic architecture. Is this similar to what happened in the first term, and what should we expect over the next 4 years?
So what that did, that day one memorandum, President Trump planted the flag, making clear that federal architecture is going to be a priority in this administration. It didn't impose anything regarding design, but rather asked the General Services Administration, the agency that oversees federal buildings, to get back to him in 60 days with recommendations about how things can be changed to, you know, protect and encourage classical, historic, and regional styles of architecture. I think basically what it was saying is, please get back to us with recommendations, and in the next couple of months, we're going to see a new executive order. I believe that the new executive order will be a perfected, improved version of the one from 2020, one that takes into account current realities on the ground. And I think it's going to make a huge splash. The order that Trump issued in his first term was extremely popular with people and commentators on the right. And really, I think it was also very popular with ordinary Americans of all political stripes. My organization did a survey by the Harris Poll to determine Americans' preferences in federal architecture. And we found that 72% of the people surveyed preferred classical and traditional design. And there were widespread majorities across all demographic groups, gender, race, socioeconomic, and political party affiliation, with 73% of Republicans favoring tradition and 70% of Democrats. So, you know, call me naive, but I think this genuinely shouldn't be a partisan issue. But President Trump has shown real statesmanship in taking the lead on this, and I think incredible things are in the works.
Justin Shubo with us, president of the National Civic Art Society at civicart.org. Justin, what is the mission of the National Endowment for the Arts, and does it have a role to play in this Trump administration?
Sure. The National Endowment for the Arts is the main funder of the arts and arts education in the country. Its annual budget is around $200 million. I think the National Endowment of the Arts for the Arts needs to play a key role in the administration, because a huge goal of this administration is to make America beautiful again. It's about public architecture, public art, and I think all of the arts in general. You know, were I to run the National Endowment for the Arts, which would be a true honor, my vision would come from Dana Gioia, who ran the NEA under George W. Bush. He said, a great nation deserves great art. And I couldn't agree more. But if you go to a contemporary art museum today, you know, you're more likely to see a banana duct taped to the wall than a piece of art that is beautiful, profound, or moving. And I think that the National Endowment for the Arts could play an essential role in changing the direction of what we are building or designing.
I'm curious if you consider yourself a bigger champion of the classical style or a bigger critic of the modern style.
I don't think it's either or. I mean, modernism dispensed with traditional forms of architecture. And there are, you know, various traditional kinds of architecture that are not strictly speaking classical. I mean, it depends how you're using the term classical. But I both oppose modernist architecture and vehemently encourage classical architecture for our public buildings. I mean, I believe that that tradition is unsurpassed in its beauty, its harmony, its ability to make us feel at home in the world. I mean, just look at where people want to live and visit on vacation. It's so often in places with beautiful traditional architecture. There is this grand tradition that I think speaks to our human nature, and I would love to see that tradition furthered in the future.
Justin Shubo is president of the National Civic Art Society at civicart.org. You can also find him on his website, shubo.com, shubow.com. Justin, thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks for having me.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Dr. Miles Smith from Hillsdale's History Department and Justin Shubo, National Civic Art Society. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Court is in session with Letter of the Law on Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM. Hello, my name is Megan Pidcock, and you're listening to Letter of the Law on Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM, where I tell you all about the world's wackiest laws that are still on the books. Washington State is known for its lush forests, the city of Seattle, and, apparently, Bigfoot sightings. Skamania County in Washington has decided to take the supposed presence of Bigfoot seriously by passing an ordinance in 1984 that banned the hunting and killing of Bigfoot, with a punishment of an up to $1,000 fine and possible jail time. This is not the first ordinance to help protect the life of Bigfoot. An initial ordinance was passed in 1969 that made it illegal to hunt Sasquatch, with a much more severe punishment of an up to $10,000 fine and up to 5 years in jail. In 1984, the City Council revisited the ordinance and decided to revise it. The decision followed an increase in activity in the area surrounding the search for Sasquatch. People were coming from all over to hunt the cryptid, causing some disturbance to locals. As a response, the county decided to make Skamania an official refuge for Bigfoot, especially since Bigfoot is classified as an endangered species. Don't worry, however, for all of you Bigfoot believers, it is still perfectly legal to go to the area to research and try and find the legend. Just keep it to pictures as proof. This has been Megan Pidcock on Letter of the Law. If you want to hear more student shows like this, go to RadioFreeHillsdale.com. Once again, you're listening to Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM.
Ballgame, where we talk about the past of America's favorite pastime. I'm Tate Christensen. Today we talk about the first night game played in the MLB. In 1935, the Cincinnati Reds were a struggling team. They could hardly draw a crowd, averaging about 2,000 fans per game. The idea was presented to bring lights to Cincinnati's Crawley Field in an attempt to bring more fans to the game. They thought that bringing in these lights would help the games to be played in the evening or at night so that people could come when they were off work. On May 24, 1935, a crowd of 20,422 fans gathered to watch the game between the Reds and the Phillies. From Washington, D.C., Franklin D. Roosevelt flipped the ceremonial switch, and lights turned on in Cincinnati, and the game was played. The Reds beat the Phillies 2-1 that night, and later in 1935, seven more night games were held in Cincinnati. Night games were later expanded to other teams in other cities. This has been the Old Ball Game on Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.